Asia Pacific, which could be avoided entirely if the United States would listen to reason.
All right, very well. We're fresh out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. William Jones there, Washington Bureau Chief of the Executive Intelligence Review. Ray McGovern, thank you. Former CIA analyst from Raleigh, North Carolina. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. It's goodbye until the next program.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Inna allatheena amanu wallatheena hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. Inna allatheena amanu wallatheena hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillahi ulaika yarjuna rahmatallah. أولئك يرجون رحمة الله والله غفور رحيم. يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
First three headlines. President Raisi orders immediate probe into a deadly terrorist attack targeting a shrine in southern Iran, as four suspects are also arrested. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemns Israeli settlers' attacks on Bedouin schools, saying such assaults are committed by organized terrorist gangs. China says it will take resolute and forceful measures over a brief visit by Taiwan's VP to the U.S. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian president has instructed authorities to immediately identify and bring to justice all those involved in a terrorist attack at a holy shrine in Iran's southern city of Shiraz. Ibrahim Raisi also expressed condolences on the tragic incident, which left at least one person dead and several wounded, one critically. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister strongly condemned the terror attack and warned of a painful end for the perpetrators and supporters of the heinous crime. The assailant was arrested after opening fire at an entrance of the Shah Cheragh Shrine. Authorities say he is currently under interrogation. Four suspects have also been arrested in connection with the terrorist attack. The holy site was targeted by the Daesh terror group last October, which then left 15 people dead. The terrorist died of the wounds that he sustained during clashes with security forces, and two of his accomplices were executed last month after being sentenced to death. Of course, one of Gisumi Shahmadi earlier gave us more details on the terrorist attack in Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine.
We do have some of the details right now. At first, it was thought that the assailants were two people. We do know that it was one person carrying 240 bullets and 8 magazines. So basically, Kaveh, this could have been a lot worse than what it is right now. Not to deny the fact that already what has happened is really tragic and very upsetting for Iranians, something that is totally unacceptable. Once again, in Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine, a religious holy site, which of course is of great significance for Iranians. The fact that this is once again being undermined less than a year after that terrorist attack you just mentioned happened last year, we're seeing this happening. But we could look at the bright side and say at least there was only one person killed this time. We do know that several people are in critical condition in hospital, and the number of those killed might increase. And, of course, 8 people in total have been injured.
Fuadizadeh is a professor at the University of Tehran. He explains who actually benefits from such terrorist attacks.
What ISIS has been doing is basically targeting Shia Muslims, not only in Syria, but in other places, in Afghanistan, in Iran, the past incident that we had. And who benefits from chaos within the Muslim countries? United States and Israel. You know, Trump, the previous U.S. president, said this repeatedly, 3 or 4 times at least. I heard it personally, that Obama and Clinton created ISIS. This goes back to Iraq and Syria, when the Obama administration decided to achieve foreign policy goals using a terrorist organization. And they were basically paying money and giving weapons to anybody who was interested in overthrowing the Syrian government at that time. Mm-hmm. So overall, I think it would be too simplistic to think that 2 individuals would engage in these type of activities without any organization and backing. ISIS has claimed responsibility, and it's not very difficult to realize that the enemies of Islam, United States, Israel, are also benefiting and directly or indirectly engage in this type of terrorism.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has condemned Israeli settler attacks against Bedouin schools east of the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. The ministry said the attacks fall within the framework of, quote, organized terrorist gangs. The ministry said the assaults are a serious escalation of settlers' attacks against Palestinian educational institutions. According to the statement, attacks are part of an Israeli plan to Judaize and to annex the West Bank. This says the regime is fully responsible for the violence. On Sunday, Israeli settlers stormed Ras Al Tin and Al Tahadi schools and threatened to demolish them. The settlers smashed the school windows and vandalized their contents under the pretext that schools are located in an area under the full control of the Israeli regime. Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip are left with seriously contaminated water due to years of Israeli blockade and multiple military attacks in recent years. Ashraf Shannon has the details in the following report.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal sliver's drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least 3 times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water.
More than 97% of Gaza's groundwater is polluted and does not meet the standards of the World Health Organization. The blockade and repeated Israeli military operations and the direct targeting of Gaza's vital infrastructure have also caused damage to water systems and affected water supply networks, further exacerbating the already existing water crisis.
The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
China has strongly condemned the U.S. for arranging a visit by the Taiwanese Vice President William Lai. Beijing says that it will take resolute and forceful measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says that Beijing is firmly opposed to any form of official exchanges between the U.S. and Taiwan. It also labeled Lai a downright troublemaker. Lai is a vocal separatist and a candidate in Taiwan's presidential elections next year. He is officially making transit stops in the U.S. en route to and from Paraguay. China claims Taiwan as its own territory. Washington does not have formal diplomatic relations with the island, but maintains close ties with the territory and is its most important international source of weapons. Geopolitical analyst Peter Koenig tells us how U.S. provocations have been backfiring in Taiwan.
This constant tension and war provocation has prompted already numerous dangerous military maneuvers and exercises in the South China Sea. And Taiwanese people are heavily under stress. I know that personally from various conversations I had with many Taiwanese in this case. What the Biden administration does apparently not realize that this nonstop provocation of Beijing does backfire. Because already today, a large proportion of Taiwanese citizens, some say more than half the Taiwanese, this is speculation, wants to integrate as soon as possible into mainland China so as to stop the provocation, the fear from war, from aggression, this stress, which is due only due to U.S. provocations and hassles. What is inevitable, and every U.S. administration knows that, is that Taiwan sooner or later will be integrated peacefully into mainland China. Today already, there are many direct and indirect relations, irreversible relations between Taiwan and China. Business relations, scientific research, joint scientific research, and investments from mainland China in Taiwan and vice versa.
Niger's military junta says that it will prosecute deposed President Mohamed Bazoum for high treason and for undermining the country's security. The junta said it has gathered evidence to prosecute Bazoum and his accomplices before the competent national and international bodies. Meanwhile, coup leaders lashed out at the Economic Community of the West African States, ECOWAS, for imposing sanctions on Niger, calling the measures illegal and inhumane. ECOWAS has been taking numerous measures to reinstate President Bazoum. The regional bloc has given the go-ahead for a military intervention in Niger. This is while an August 6 deadline set by the ECOWAS was ignored by the military junta. Coup leaders say that they are ready for a diplomatic resolution to the standoff with ECOWAS.
Anti-French sentiment runs high in Niger as thousands of people have rallied near a French military base on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, to call for the withdrawal of the country's forces. Protesters shouted "down with France" and "down with ECOWAS" as they surrounded the base. The demonstrators argue that the West African regional bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS has given the green light for a military intervention in Niger after it approved the deployment of a standby force as part of its effort to remove Niger military rulers following last month's coup and reinstate deposed pro-Western leader Mohamed Bazoum. The Ivory Coast president says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. The president said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. He said other member countries will join them later. France has thrown its full backing to all the conclusions of the West African leaders who met in Nigerian capital Abuja to make the necessary arrangements. The United States has also voiced support for efforts of ECOWAS on Niger.
As significantly, ECOWAS, the organization that brings together West African countries, is playing a lead role in making clear the imperative of the return to constitutional order, and we very much support ECOWAS's leadership and work on this.
The support for ECOWAS efforts come as a deadline set by the regional bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August 6th was ignored by Nigerian junta. The junta has moved one step further and announced a new government there. The developments in Niger come nearly 3 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blockaded access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdurrahman Tiani took control of the country's political leadership there.
The idea of a military intervention is being pushed by certain countries like France and the U.S. This is because the two Western countries are seeking their political and economic interests in Niger, pushing ECOWAS to do whatever it can to reinstate the former pro-West leader.
The idea of a military intervention in Niger comes as many people across the West African nation are opposed to foreign meddling in their internal political affairs.
Today they're in front of our army. It's no longer that they're in front of us. That's to say, if they're thinking of attacking the military, they will first have to attack us, the people of Niger.
But unlike Nigerians, Western countries, namely France and the United States, are pushing for a military intervention there. After all, there are certain facts that lie within their interest, which a change in Nigerian political leadership can hamper all those benefits. In the case of France, the country has domination over Niger's economy. That's why Paris has been seeking a military solution to the crisis in Niger since the very first day of the outbreak of the coup there. One significant factor is Niger's vast uranium reserves. The country supplies around 5% of the world's uranium and is a leading supplier of that chemical element to the European Union. The French government is almost entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to countries like Germany and other European nations. The electricity export of that amount makes French huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, and that is why, seeing its political interests in tatters, it is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate pro-West former President Bazoum. With ECOWAS being under the direct influence of Western powers, an actual military intervention in Niger is not unthinkable, despite repeated warnings from Russia that any such move would destabilize the whole region. But apart from that, what matters most of all is that Niger belongs to Nigerians, and they are the ones who should decide their own fate. Given all the anti-Western hatred among the people of Niger and other West African nations, it seems that it is for the Western countries to stop meddling in the affairs of those nations and let people choose their own political path.
Argentina's ruling coalition is heading for defeat in the presidential primaries as the far-right outsider emerges as the biggest vote-getter. Anti-establishment Javier Milei is so far in the lead with 32% of the votes. That's out of 73% of the ballots counted. The candidates of the main conservative bloc and the ruling coalition are trailing him with 28% and 26% of the votes, respectively. Primaries serve as a clear indication of the favorite to win in the October elections. Deeply unpopular President Alberto Fernandez is not seeking re-election. That comes amid public outrage with year-on-year inflation at 115%, poverty soaring, and the value of the peso nosediving. The death toll from the Hawaii wildfires has now risen to 93 amid growing anger over the response to the deadliest U.S. blaze in 100 years. Hawaiian authorities say the number of fatalities will increase further as hundreds are still uncontactable. unaccounted for, that is. The fire has damaged or destroyed more than 2,200 structures in the hard-hit town of Lahaina. It has also left thousands homeless. Officials have launched an investigation into the handling of the fire, as residents are complaining that there had been no warnings. Hawaii Congresswoman Jill Tokuda says officials had underestimated the danger of the devastating fire. The blaze has been described as the worst natural disaster in the island's history.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willest, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me.
Presence mostly induce meanings like fear and horror. There are many prisons around the world that are notorious for being dangerous and horrifying, like the U.S. Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba. Or the Belmarsh prison in the UK. Such prisons, how much frightening they be, keep humans as prisoners. But today, I'm visiting a prison where demons are being kept. Okay. It's just a story which locals say. Whatever they say, this place is an extinct volcano with an empty crater, which is known as the Solomon's Prison or Demon's Prison, which is located in West Azerbaijan province. It's for about 20 minutes that I have been hiking in this mountain, And I think I'm close to it. The Solomon Prison is a 100-meter cone-shaped hill with a horrible hole inside and a strange story. Located in West Azerbaijan province, northwestern Iran. The hill has been shaped over thousands of years by sediment layers of mineral stones of an ancient lake. It used to be a temple between 830 and 660 BCE with several sulfur hot springs around it for medical treatment. Unlike other volcanoes, the prison hill is made of sediment layers of mineral stones. There used to be a spring in the region, which turned into a lake over time. Its water was filled with salts and sulfur. Through time, the salts resided at the bottom of the lake, becoming solid sediment layers. Now, after thousands of years, the layers have shaped the hill with a hole inside. Gradually, the lake dried out, but its remnants are still visible. The fortified site is the first attraction of West Azerbaijan province, recognized as a World Heritage Site in July 2003. Forget about the modern prison structure with bars. It doesn't look like a prison at all. It's actually a hole at the top of the mountain. There are many myths and stories about this mountain. Locals believe that a disobedient demon was once jailed in this hole. And anybody daring to set foot into the black hole will be murdered, locals believe. That's why it is named the Demon's Prison. This is just a story. True or not, it doesn't matter. But the fact is, this place was once a fire temple, tomb, sundial. Anything. Anyway, it is worth climbing the edge of the volcano and looking inside. And the smell. It is the smell of sulfur. Mountaineering equipment to go inside the hole, but actually, I don't have the guts to do so. I'm not that skillful. However, I've brought a quadcopter with a camera attached on it. This can take videos or photos from inside. Hold on, please. Hold on. Okay, that's it. Let me tell you something. Many things have been discovered from this hole. Things like skeletons, spearheads, or something like it. This is well worth to climb to get here, exactly to the top. And looking down into the crater is a great experience. Also, stunning views from the top. Yeah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Palestinian Authority was formed nearly 30 years ago following an agreement between the Palestine Liberation Organization and Israel in 1994. But it's been heavily criticized for allowing itself to be manipulated by the Israelis into becoming a Zionist agent of oppression. So in this episode of Palestine Declassified, we'll be examining the record of the Palestinian Authority since its inception. And that record has been influenced by British intelligence figures who've had a hand in shaping its direction, as Latifa Abu Chakra will explain in this report.
We need the Palestinian Authority. It does our job for us. We're ready to help it financially. We cannot allow it to collapse. These are the words of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu regarding the Palestinian Authority, which is currently arresting heroic Palestinian resistance fighters in the West Bank. It's well known that the US military and CIA have trained the Palestinian Authority to serve Israel, but according to recent work by the Electronic Intifada, it seems that role may have also been outsourced by Israel to British intelligence figures. Adam Smith International purports to be a global advisory company. Through leaked documents obtained by the Electronic Intifada, it is clear that the shadowy group has been influencing the Palestinian Authority for 15 years. This influence includes a British military officer giving daily direction to the PA. Just some of the British agents dispatched to train the loyal pups of the Palestinian Authority are David Haynes, who worked in the British consulate in occupied Al-Quds and helped the Palestinian Authority establish itself with a particular focus on capacity building. Haynes acknowledges working on coordination between British and Israeli intelligence agencies. Michael Frayn, a former member of Northern Ireland's Royalty Ulster Constabulary, who also worked closely with Israel's Shin Bet against what he terms Islamic-based terrorist organizations. Anthony Malkin, a former British Army colonel and military intelligence officer, established a Palestinian Authority training school and designed courses for its officers. David Robson is a former British Army intelligence officer who later went on to be the commander of the 1st Signal Brigade, a UK NATO Army unit. John Derville, former deputy commander of operational intelligence in Iraq, also oversaw the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. He did this directly under the supervision of the infamous US General Dayton, who describes Derville as the finest senior strategic mind I have ever encountered. What is the true extent of British service to the Zionists in occupied Palestine?
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Asa Winstanley. Asa's an investigative journalist and associate editor with the Electronic Intifada. He also co-hosts the Electronic Intifada podcast and publishes a weekly Substack newsletter called Palestine is Still the Issue. His latest book, Weaponizing Antisemitism, How the Israel Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn, was published in May this year, and we reviewed it on episode 75 of Palestine Declassified. Welcome to the show. Asa, tell us about this statement from Benjamin Netanyahu that Israel needs the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah, at the end of June, it came out in the Israeli media that in a private interior security cabinet meeting, Netanyahu had said this to his senior ministers, that they couldn't allow the Palestinian Authority to collapse. With the rise of the armed Palestinian resistance in the West Bank in the last couple of years, the Palestinian Authority's armed forces have increasingly lost control of certain areas of the West Bank, which form the sort of the headquarters of the resistance. And it's meant that there are areas, specifically the Jenin refugee camp and areas of Nablus, which are increasingly out of their control. And so there's been increased speculation that the Palestinian Authority could collapse, especially when its current leader, Mahmoud Abbas, dies because he's reaching 90 years old now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Netanyahu declared his intent to prop up the Palestinian Authority financially if necessary. Mm.
Well, David, I mean, what do you make of Britain's influence on the Palestinian Authority?
Well, it's very interesting that not just the CIA, but also British intelligence have been involved in working there. And you see, it's just part of a pattern of British involvement with the agencies which they think can pursue their interests. So, of course, we've seen in Syria, we saw the propping up of the so-called moderate rebels, the Islamic groups which were fighting against the Assad government. And we've seen in the Ukraine, of course, propping up the Nazi battalions allied with the Ukrainian government. And in this case, we've got secular nationalists who are being propped up by British intelligence. So it shows the way in which British intelligence operates, that it will take whatever group it thinks it can to pursue its interests, and it will use them to try and point them in a particular direction. And this, of course, shows that what they're doing is that the Palestinian Authority is being used as an implement and as a vehicle for Western interests as well as to help to prop up the Zionist regime.
Well, Asa, I mean, I wonder whether you could say a word or two about Adam Smith International.
Yeah, the best way to describe Adam Smith International, as we described it in the piece, was that they are essentially a spy contractor. They're mercenary spies. It's a kind of outsourced form of British intelligence, really, and it poses a sort of development agency. But what it does is it gathers information around the world on the pretext of all these projects. And sometimes they even have... I mean, we previously covered from the same set of leaked documents how they were using an academic pretext, sending young researchers into Palestinian refugee camps to essentially spy on Palestinian refugees. And Adam Smith International has these kinds of operations all around the world, especially concentrated in West Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. But anywhere where British security and intelligence deems that it has its own sort of quote-unquote national interest.
It seems to be a trend, doesn't it, as well, sort of outsourcing the sort of intelligence operations, doesn't it, to the private sector? I mean,
yeah, it's increasingly, you know, as David mentioned, the CIA, the British intelligence services, and also the Israeli intelligence services outsource their operations to cutouts and front organisations. Not an entirely new phenomenon, but in the last couple of decades, especially, we've seen it increase as a kind of privatisation of spying, I suppose.
Absolutely. Well, David, I mean, you mentioned Syria in your previous answer. I wonder whether you could just say a word or two about Adam Smith International's links to the war on Syria.
So, in the case of Syria, I mean, the British were involved in creating a whole range of different cutouts and fronts and spending millions and millions of pounds on different contractors ARC or IncoStrat or Adam Smith International. And in the case of Adam Smith International, they were involved in many of the operations to support the war against the Assad government and to try and bring down the Assad government, which was an objective of Western foreign policy. And they were, in fact, running the police force in what they referred to as liberated areas of Syria, i.e. areas that the armed groups had taken from the government of President Assad. And it was even revealed on Panorama that they were effective, that Adam Smith International were working directly with Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. And it's such a scandal that they had to stop doing that, and they think that whole project collapsed. But they were involved in a whole series of other projects where it was clear that they were involved with Nusra affiliates, with al-Qaeda affiliates, and indeed, to some extent, with ISIS in Syria. And this was, of course, part of the strategy of the British government, was to work with these organisations and pretend that these were moderate guerrillas who were just engaged in a struggle to bring down the government. But actually, of course, they ended up working with organisations which in the UK would be regarded as terrorist organisations. And if anyone here worked with them, they would be put in jail as a terrorist. But nevertheless, the British government was working directly with these organisations in Syria. And that's the kind of the morality and the politics of these projects.
I mean, it's astonishing. But, I mean, how do they kind of rationalise? How do they justify then? I mean, what's the purpose behind this?
They rationalise it and they justify it in terms of British foreign policy objectives. And that's the same as their involvement with Ukraine and working closely with Azov and IDAR and the right sector in Ukraine. And the same as their oppositions. You know, in general, if secular nationalism in the Middle East opposes British imperialism, well, they'll work with some other organisation that opposes it. But if secular nationalism in the form of the Palestinian Authority can be a useful vehicle, as far as they're concerned, they'll work closely with that. They don't mind as long as it's pursuing Western interests, their conception of Western interests.
Sure. No, indeed. Well, Ace, I mean, I know you've written about Adam Smith International spying on Palestinians in refugee camps. I mean, what on earth is that all about?
Yeah, this was... these agents of Adam Smith International, they were former British intelligence and military agents, essentially, and so they did all this kind of spying. And what was really interesting was the large degree of crossover with the project that David just mentioned in Syria. Some of the personnel who were involved in this spying on the Palestinian refugee camps and what we described as infiltration of the Palestinian Authority and direction of the Palestinian Authority also either went on to or had previously worked for this so-called Free Syria Police project in Syria, and that was the public face of it, that it was to promote democracy and free. And these were unarmed police, ostensibly, but what that meant in practice was that they ended up having their security, which were their or protection, quote-unquote, which was essentially al-Qaeda. And so even though it was wrapped up after the Panorama exposure and there was questions asked about it publicly, it was wrapped up, it was seen at what we found in these documents was they were still promoting it internally in their bids to the British government, because of course this is a private company and it is a profit-making company, a very wealthy company. They have to, on paper, they have to make all these bids to the British government, and they were still promoting their success in Syria and the Free Syrian Police Project. And so they went on to do these other projects like spying on Palestinian refugees. The stated goal there was to combat al-Qaeda in the West Bank. Yeah. That was the stated goal. So this is the irony. They were working with the al-Qaeda in Syria, and yet they wanted to combat al-Qaeda in the West Bank. It's a very unlikely story, especially considering there's no presence of al-Qaeda in the West Bank.
Sure.
And there is never even... In the Gaza Strip, there's only ever been a very minimal presence of al-Qaeda, which was removed and neutralised by the Hamas authorities.
Well, David, I mean, briefly, what's the Palestinian Authority doing to quell resistance in the West Bank?
Well, I mean, it's taken on a very dubious role, hasn't it? It's been there to support and coordinate with the Zionist forces, with the Shin Bet, the Israelis intelligence agency, And as a result, there've been internally in the Palestinian Authority, there've been splits. Some of the people who are formerly part of the armed wing of the PLO and the brigades there, they've actually joined the resistance and fought with Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the PFLP. But in general, the Palestinian Authority has not done that and has continued to coordinate in security terms with the Israelis, and indeed, of course, has been coordinating in the sense of actually actively stopping resistance fighters going to confront the Israelis. And that has led to widespread alarm and distress, distaste for the Palestinian Authority, such that they've even had some of their facilities fired upon by the resistance.
Yes.
And they've arrested a whole series of people from the resistance, and the resistance have said these are political arrests, which they manifestly are. Yeah. But the Palestinian Authority says, no, these were criminals. They were rude about the Palestinian Authority. And that's the kind of level we've got here. And it's a dangerous course for the Palestinian Authority. And, of course, they may, as Is has said, they may collapse as a result.
Yes, yes. Well, look, we're just going to pause the discussion there for a moment to report about what happened to Nizar Banat, who was a prominent critic of the Palestinian Authority.
Outspoken Palestinian political analyst Nizar Banat was killed at his home by agents of the Palestinian Authority in June 2021. Nizar was very active online, regularly commenting on events in the region. Unlike others in supposedly pro-Palestinian circles, he criticized the NGO industrial complex and was grateful to the Islamic Republic of Iran for its key role in the resistance axis against the Zionist entity. Perhaps his clarity was the reason the Palestinian Authority targeted him. Nizar Banat had been arrested several times on the totalitarian charge of inciting strife against the Palestinian Authority due to posts on his personal Facebook account. Banat was the head of a Palestinian political grouping named the Freedom and Dignity List. He was intending to participate in the 2021 Palestinian legislative elections before they were postponed by the Palestinian Authority. Following that decision, Banat called out the Palestinian Authority online and requested that the European Union cut aid to the Quislings for their undemocratic practices. His house was then attacked by PA forces in response, with a team of agents invading his home and beating him to death. CCTV captures Nizar's lifeless body being dragged from the home and dumped into a waiting car by PA. This was the ultimate conclusion of a life lived in struggle, but the solid commitment, principle, and clarity of Nizar Banat will live on forever through his many social media lectures. Despite throwing their worst at him, Nizar Banat chose to die on his feet rather than live on his knees. And though they killed the man, they could not kill the idea.
David, what was Nizar Banat's position on the resistance axis?
Well, he was a big supporter of the resistance axis, and of course, what that means is a big supporter of all of the resistance operations through Hezbollah, in Iraq, in Yemen, and of course, the support given by both the Syrians and most of, obviously, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, you know, I talked once a few months ago about Iran, and I got some criticism for defending Iran. And my response to when people said about Iran is, well, you know, if you want to know about what the Iranians' position on Palestine is, ask the Palestinian resistance.
Yeah.
And when you do go and ask the Palestinian resistance, they're very clear. Hamas is very clear. Palestinian Islamic Jihad are very clear. The PFLP are very clear that they welcome the support from the Islamic Republic of Iran, and it's crucial in their resistance against Zionism.
I mean, Aysa, you actually met, certainly saw Nizar Banat, didn't you, a number of years ago? I mean, tell us about that encounter.
I was present at a conference of the BDS National Committee around a decade ago, and I wrote a couple of reports about it at the time for the Electronic Intifada. It was in a national conference in Palestine in occupied Bethlehem, and it was an interesting conference, and there was a panel in which there, for whatever reason, one of the ministers of the Palestinian Authority was speaking, and it was a national conference. It was obviously all in Arabic, but it was, you know, there was a decent budget, and there was simultaneous translation put on for guests like myself. And the Palestinian Authority minister was essentially basically spewing sort of these kinds of, you know, just generic interventions where he was trying to say that the Palestinian Authority was involved, trying to claim credit for boycotts and so forth. And someone got up from the crowd and in the Q&A session and criticised him and said, you know, the Palestinian Authority are the people who are leading the coordination with Israel. So how can you talk about boycotts of Israel when your forces are actually essentially collaborating with the Palestinian Authority security forces? Well, this man was later revealed to me that it was Nizar Binat. Sure. And it was only years later that I put the incidents together. But he was a very well-known activist. His videos were incredibly popular. Even after that event, you know, he was roughed up. He was beaten up by the minister's goons.
Immediately after that event?
Yeah, really? Yeah. And it was, you know, it was a story at the time in local media. And the minister was then basically chased out. He fled the event. He was sort of embarrassed, and he fled out of the event, and sure. Because he started to. You know, Nizar, from my impression was that Nizar had been quite polite in his intervention, but the minister responded and said he was barking like a dog.
What was the response like from the other people in the audience, as it were?
People were supporting him. Yeah. You know, they were saying that, you know, they were applauding him and so forth. And I don't really understand why the minister was invited in the first place, to be honest, when the Palestinian Authority has done its best to undermine the BDS movement all along. And that's been its role. But, Nizar Binat's videos were... When you go onto his Facebook page, and it was, you know, I believe he had hundreds of thousands of followers, and his videos, you know, in very sort of vernacular Palestinian Arabic, were very down to earth, and they spoke to sure. the masses. And he was
explicit. Asa mentioned Facebook there. I mean, the Palestinian Authority has been arresting people for social media posts, haven't they, David? I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, including Nizar Binat, yes. I mean, the just for putting on your own Facebook that you are opposed to or that you've criticised in some way the Palestinian Authority, and people are being rounded up for these things. And there's a real sense, especially in those areas of the West Bank that Asa was talking about, in Nablus and in Jenin, that the Palestinian Authority is over, and that there will be no more collaboration with it. The statements which you see from the armed groups, the armed resistance factions in the West Bank, they're all quite restrained in some respects, in the sense that they're not declaring war directly on the Palestinian Authority, although there are actually clashes happening. But it's very clear that the next step would be open confrontation.
Sure.
That's the logic of this situation. If they continue with the collaboration with Israel and helping Israel to arrest and assassinate and torture resistance fighters, well, that's not going to go well for the Palestinian Authority.
Mm. And Asa, I mean, tell us about the series of events that followed Nizar Binat's call on the EU to cut funding to the Palestinian Authority.
The Palestinian Authority is supported by the EU and by the Western powers and by Israel. You know, we've seen that is what happens. You know, and there was criticism. You know, after he was killed by the Palestinian Authority, there was these kind of criticisms from EU officials, especially, and there was this ostensible sympathy. There was even a piece in the Jewish Chronicle which was about it. But, of course, the Jewish Chronicle, a very pro-Israel newspaper, omitted all his actual views. They just said, oh, he was a political opponent of the Palestinian Authority, and they were using it as a way to criticise the Palestinian Authority. Mm. But they omitted the fact that he was very explicit in his support for the armed resistance. And as you said, the support of Iran for... the Palestinian resistance, and he has one particular video which you can see translated into English where he talks very sarcastically about critics of Iran in the Arab world who say, you know, oh yeah, we support resistance but we're against Iran because they're trying to achieve political
yes,
objectives
indeed.
And he said, where do you think you get your rockets from?
Yes, exactly.
Where do the arms come from? They come from Iran.
No, indeed. Well, David, I mean, what was the response of other Palestinian groups to the killing of Nizar Barnett?
So there's been outrage, and it's been a long process since then, especially through his family, trying to get justice for him. And, of course, the justice has been denied. There's been no proper investigation. The people who were arrested for his death have been allowed out on bail and have been released. So there's been no proper response to this. And, of course, he is kind of an iconic figure there. And, of course, the Palestinian groups support him as they develop their kind of what they call their operations at present, the unity of the fields, by which they mean that all the different armed factions are working together in new groups which contain people from both Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas and the PFLP and sometimes the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, all acting together to target the Israeli forces when they try and invade the refugee camps, like in Jenin, for example.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. So let me thank our guest, Asa Wynne-Stanley, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next week, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
France's colonial rule in Africa began in the 19th century. Many might think that the days of cruel exploitation, massacre, slavery, and psychological abuse of African people in the hands of the French have come to an end. But the recent developments in countries like Niger show Paris still has its hand over the continent. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. According to Tehran Times, the latest African country to rise up against French dominance is Niger, where the military managed to overthrow the Western-backed government of Mohamed Bazoum in July. Western regimes have resorted to their usual tactic and began a propaganda campaign against the coup, which in fact seems to enjoy the support of most Nigerian people. Instead of talking about why the coup has happened and what people had been demanding from the previous governments, the West has decided to reduce the event to an authoritative act and call it a threat against democracy. The American and European governments reacted exactly the same way when similar events happened in Mali and Burkina Faso in 2021 and 2022. The two countries, similar to Niger, finally drew